Are you there, Brian?
Hi-o.
I will speak daggers to her, but use none.
We're going to go into risky territory here. Brian has been checking out McLuhan's personal copies of Time and Western Man. I think that's what you got there, right, Brian?
Yep.
Now, look at that topic, 1926-27 Ion, Time and Western Man. Now, hold back your objection to the idea of time. Let's see what McLuhan says about time, commenting on what Lewis writes. So, Brian, have you got a quote or two?
I like sure, this place and willingly could waste my time in it. Act 2, Scene 4.
That's not Tar, the novel.
As You Like It.
Oh. Okay, give us a quote, Brian.
Yeah, well, that applies to me being at the Fisher Library there. I could willingly waste my time looking up McLuhan's, and I like Time and Western Man, too. It's just a good reminder of how bitter
a thing is it to look into happiness through another man's eyes.
Is that Lewis or Hamlet?
As You Like It.
Okay, Ian, let Brian give some quotes. I'll just put you on mute for a second, Ian, so Brian can
quote. Another
quote,
a fool does thinking is wise, but the wise man knows himself to be a fool. How many more quotes would you like, Bob?
Perfect. That's
that's enough. I want to have Brian tell us what McLuhan said about Lewis's quote.
Hey.
Never mind. You'll remember. Just relax. So, Brian, quick. I just muted Ion. He could have a tantrum about that. But what is your first annotation you want to point out?
Well, there's definitely one thing that's very worth pointing out is the pretty fair evidence for the claim that McLuhan, somewhere you talk about it, it's like, well, McLuhan got it from Lewis. That is his basic thing that, you know, people would more associate it with Innes, McLuhan's whole basic spiel. But it seems to be the best spot that I'm just looking for the particular page here, that when Lewis is talking about Spengler, I guess, what was his name, Oswald Spengler or something?
Yeah.
Klein of the West.
Yes.
And I didn't know this about Spengler, but apparently Spengler was whipping out something very similar to
quote.
That. let's see. We got the point is that McLuhan has noted beside, it's not a very specific quote.
Conscience is but a word that cowards use, devised at first to keep the strong in awe.
So what about Spengler you didn't know?
I didn't realize that Spengler had such a similar vision, that he described a similar thing to McLuhan in the sense he described a pattern of where that the physics of an era is basically identical to or determined by the politics of the era or the politics that it grew up in. So Lewis was reviewing Spengler's whole idea of, for example, Spengler says, every atomic theory, therefore, is a myth and not an experience. In it, the culture reveals its inmost essence and very self. So, you know, that, like, that the different theories of the atom are basically political theories dressed up in the speculative science language. And so that's interesting, you know, it's close to the kind of McLuhan thing, and basically Lewis's response to this idea is that there's clearly something to that, but I reject that idea, especially the way that Spengler then tries to say that the root of it is race, based on this idea that Spinoza and Hertz were two Jewish guys that both didn't intuit or didn't like the idea of force, making the idea of force central in their philosophy.
Right.
So Lewis was very explicitly ambiguous on this in a very, like, I clearly reject that. You could come up with other exceptions that prove the opposite. What about Einstein, et cetera? But there's clearly something to that as well. But he says, I believe that, Lewis says, I certainly don't reject some influence on speculative thought, but it does it very differently, I believe, from the manner of Spengler's description. And right beside that, McLuhan noted theory of communication.
Theory of communication, so, yeah.
So right there, it's McLuhan saying, like, well, that's the way that it does it differently. It influences that, you know, physics or the theories of what people think is that.
Okay, so I didn't get the noun. Well, what is Lewis saying is causing the influence, and what is Spengler saying is causing the influence?
Spengler is saying that it's basically politics, but that the politics of a time is what is, that it's like the whole culture of a time, but primarily it's politics is what.
Okay, so Lewis says it's not politics. What's Lewis say it is?
Lewis basically begs off that question. I didn't copy a lot of quotes from this because he doesn't ultimately come up with his own theory of what it is. He basically just says that there's definitely some kind of influence, but I think it does it differently from Spengler's description, but he doesn't then say what he thinks it is. Basically more like this is something to think about, I don't know.
Well, he develops it later. He gets onto the media. Yes. That's why McLuhan puts theory of communication. You know, McLuhan has an essay, An Interior Landscape, on Wyndham Lewis called Wyndham Lewis's Theory of Communication. That's 1953. Right. But both Innes and McLuhan got this mediacology. Once Lewis started to get more handle on the technical ground, both of them, Innes, got his stuff from Lewis.
Innes as well was influenced?
Oh, yeah. There's a biography called Marginal Man came out a few years ago where the writer talks about the big influence of Wyndham Lewis. So when I was rereading Bias of Communication a couple of weeks ago, when Innes, in his essay, A Plea for Time, that's like his personal statement about what he wants to happen. He quotes like 8 times Wyndham Lewis at the end of the essay. So his very personal declaration for A Plea for Time, where they retrieved the oral tradition, and I figured out that he means tactility by the oral tradition. But anyways, he called it the oral tradition, and he says A Plea for Time, and he's quoting a whole bunch of Lewis at the end of his essay. Now, Innes' son said that when the biography came out that Lewis did not influence his father, but I think the son was just worried about the bad reputation of Lewis because it's obvious. And then when you read Empire and Communications, which came out the year before Bias of Communication, that's really the book filled with data. There you see the eye-ear dialectic that Lewis uses. You see it all through Innes. So Innes definitely and McLuhan are products of Lewis, supporting my claim that the father of mediacology is Wyndham Lewis with a little James Joyce and a little Pound and Eliot thrown in there. And they're all reacting to Duke Ellington. The problem is Duke Ellington. What do we do? Jazz has united the world. Duke's the king. What are we writers supposed to do? That's the issue.
All the most important philosophers are reacting to what do we do about Duke Ellington.
That's right. That's what was happening. Did you know that Duke Ellington was a personal friend of McLuhan's and often visited the coach host?
I knew that they met or something. I didn't know that there was any kind of closeness there.
Yeah, Mark Stewart was the secretary at the time and was quite excited when Duke Ellington would show up. He told me that.
The main theme of things that I noted, anyway, and one of the main themes in Time and Western Man, he's talking about the behaviorist kind of science view of humans and thought, and this very derogatory view of thought and words in particular. And the most basic dyad that Lewis brings it down to, which McLuhan underlines and refers to as a page number in other places, is basic dyad of it is action and not contemplation is most people's affair. That's the most kind of important dyad that Lewis uses to differentiate or to diagnose what's messed up about this whole behaviorist view. And McLuhan underlines that sentence, and he refers to it in other places by page number to come back to this action versus contemplation.
McLuhan does italicize action when he's talking about the bias of Gutenberg man. Because they're visually stultified or enhanced or numbed, they balance it off with kinetic movement. They fill in the visual space gap. So Western man is always restless, always going somewhere. That's the action. And then McLuhan and Lewis translate it into passions or appetite for sensory extensions comes from the effect of visual space, which leads to this fetish for action, and McLuhan italicizes action.
that totally makes sense with this idea of the behaviorist kind of cartoon view of things, that the kind of natural state or the default and true or something state of the organism and humans by extension is action and reaction. And
yes.
The behaviorists are always looking for this, like, you know, objectively visible and quantifiable, recordable behavior and action, and this idea that thinking and words is basically nothing more than some kind of a delay or a needless loss of action, that, you know, you get the stimulus, and then instead of just responding somehow with some sort of action, that the person goes into some sort of shock where they deal with it in their head for some reason.
Right. Now, the word behaviors is code in McLuhan land for kinetic bias. He talks about, Lewis does a satire on the behaviorist science in Snooty Baronet, and maybe another novel around that time, in the early 30s. So you'll see McLuhan use the word behaviorist for America's biased.
Right.
Bias of kinetic, and behaviorist is the only science they could come up with. Didn't last long, because television and tactility wiped it out, but it's interesting. You'll notice Lewis goes on about the concepts of behaviorism. It's like Lewis doesn't figure out the technical ground until Men Without Art, 1934. Mm-hmm. He does a little bit in Art of Being Ruled, but it's very interesting how Lewis, as being intellectual, he's looking at the ideas that are affecting people, like the time philosophies of Einstein and William James and Bergson and these people. He's thinking the ideas do it, but he then brings in a lot of technical effects after that. So he doesn't seem to say media ecology precisely is the technical environment that McLuhan and Lewis say later. That's why you're finding it hard to find out what Lewis means in Time and Western Man, what he's saying. He's not committing himself to what the cause is.
He's definitely not committing himself, which is good, I guess, rather than people like, well, if I'm writing a book, I better take some guess and stick to it. You know, he's more just content to just diagnose the basic foolishness or something, or make fun of
the zeitgeist. He's saying people are being hypnotized by the zeitgeist caused by the new technical environment. Now, he does get specific in 1938 when the big museum there would not allow his portraits, his what later became known as the greatest British portraits ever. The museum wouldn't let Lewis display. And he said, well, that whole gang over there in that big museum, whatever it was called back then, they're just a product of the camera. See, so he made a McLuhan statement. He says they're just reacting to the camera. So in the late 30s, he could talk technically as a media ecologist. It's hard to figure out when he actually got that clear, in between 1926 and 1938.
What year did America and Cosmic Man come out?
1948. He's a full-blown media ecologist when that book's come out. In that book, he's back in Europe, and he's telling the Europeans, you are not going to provide the melting pot, the new global theater, global village, because you're not America. America has the technology and the culture and everything that will make the new civilization. And that was a shock to the Europeans who thought Paris was where it was at. And he's telling you people, I've been to the mountaintop, I've been to the United States, you know, during World War II, and I saw what was growing there, and you guys are going to be incompetent in relation to what's happening. And that got borne out, eh? You got the French pissed off at McDonald's and Disney and all their provincialism that the Europeans have in relation to the global American environment, the Mick environment of America.
Yeah.
The Mick environment, M-C.
There was a note where McLuhan says, CS, like related to Wyndham Lewis, is finally seeing this in America and Cosmic Man. And what that was a note to is Lewis talking about Schopenhauer, and he says, and what a good preparation for the modern industrial world, this pseudo-Asiatic renunciation of the will to self was.
Is that Schopenhauer he's saying?
Lewis is talking about Schopenhauer. Pseudo-Asiatic renunciation of the will to self, McLuhan underlines and says, yes, Wyndham Lewis is finally seeing this in America and Cosmic Man.
He writes those words?
So, yeah, what McLuhan underlines the phrase where Wyndham Lewis is summarizing Schopenhauer.
Yeah.
Wyndham Lewis writes, pseudo-Asiatic renunciation of the will to self. McLuhan underlines that and says, CF, Wyndham Lewis is finally seeing this in America and Cosmic Man.
What's CS?
Oh, what just the little CF.
CF meaning reference. C is in
yeah.
Carolyn. CF is in F and Frank. Yeah, that means reference. C, American Cosmic Man. Yeah, it's in American Cosmic Man, comes out in 48, that Lewis describes the global village. And that's
right.
Where McLuhan gets it. From Lewis.
The world is grown so bad that wrens make prey where eagles dare not perch.
Which one is that?
King Richard III.
Where angels
one,
fear
scene
to tread.
Three.
I shouldn't have brought up Shakespeare. We're going to get Shakespeare all night.
Wisely and slow, they stumble that run fast.
Go ahead, Brian.
There's one note or a few notes that he repeats that I'm not sure what McLuhan's referring to. He seems to contrast at different times. McLuhan says CNS for central nervous system. There's another one that's AAP. Do you know what that might mean?
Never heard of that. Sounds like anthropomorphic physical. That's what I use.
Yeah, like he repeats it a couple times. There was a, for example, Lewis is talking about Leibniz in relation to the unconscious. Okay, this is Lewis on Leibniz. Lewis says, the unconscious itself was invented by Leibniz in the course of his lifelong struggle with Locke. With his egalitarian predilections, he located in the unconscious the pantheistic egalitarian heaven for his monads to pass into when they wished. Just as with his monad, he invented the smallest possible form of God.
Ion, can you bring McLuhan in and tell us what AAP is?
Some rise by sin and some fall by virtue.
What are you quoting there?
Oh, measure for measure, Act 2, Scene 1.
Can you bring in McLuhan or yourself and say what AAP stands for?
He will give the devil his due.
Ooh.
Is that another quote?
King Henry IV, Act 1, Scene 2.
We're playing tennis with Shakespeare tonight.
Yes. Scene 2? Was it Scene 2 he said? King.
Delays have dangerous ends.
Right.
Henry VI, Act 3, Scene 2. Delays have dangerous ends.
Go ahead, Brian.
The Lewis quote about Leibniz continues, just as with his monad he invented the smallest possible form of God. Kant identified the unconscious as the seat of sexual love, and placing that alongside Leibniz's identification of it with the common soul of humanity, that is, Leibniz's identification of the unconscious with the common soul of humanity, McLuhan underlines that last phrase, Leibniz's identification of the unconscious with the common soul of humanity, and beside that writes CNS.
Printing press created the unconscious, you know, the Freudian
right.
Unconscious repression because of the imbalance of the sensory mix. The electric environment retrieves collective consciousness, so that's why he put CNS in there. But what's interesting is Lewis gets it. Lewis conceptually is naming the philosophers who are creating and talking about the unconscious and the effect of visual space. That's a pretty... appropriate
yeah,
there.
Yeah, definitely, because I don't think it would be at all an easy or obvious perception to locate the invention of the unconscious like very far before Freud or before electricity or a Nietzschean looking into the kind of like what you're really thinking when you say this moral is this other thing that isn't as nice. You know, but so far before Nietzsche.
Now, Ion says that the Dark Ages come in with the printing press, and then the telegraph releases us from that. So I'm saying you agree with Lewis and McLuhan there about the effect of the veil through the printing press creating this unconscious, which in the 20th century is released. Would you qualify what I'm saying, Ion?
Beware the Ides of March.
That's tomorrow.
That's one of the greatest hits.
Beware the Ides of March. Now, what do we beware, Ion? The calendar itself?
Timon of Athens, we have seen better days. Timon of Athens. Act 4, Scene 2.
That's one of Wyndham Rose's first paintings, Timon of Athens.
Yeah, that's a major. Yes.
Yeah, it's a painting that refers to the Shakespeare play, Timon of Athens. Not so well known.
It's still a quote. That's what you want. It was a quote. You asked for a quote. You said we have a quote. You talk about Shakespeare. You said it's Shakespeare. You said Shakespeare quotes. You wanted a quote. So it's Shakespeare. You wanted to refer to the quotes, and you had the quotes, and you want a quote. So we quote the quotes, and then we quote the quoted quotes, and then you want to know why Corinne is so upset.
Timon of Athens is a major work and one of Lewis's earliest paintings, Brian. Very appropriate Ion quotes that. Ion, this visual space, the effect of the printing press creating the Dark Ages, isn't that creating an unconscious, a major limitation for little men that electric environment releases the little men from slightly?
Nothing will come from nothing.
Electricity is an extension of tactile nothing. So there's the tactile nothing coming from the visual space, abstract void. See? Nothing can come from nothing.
King Lear, Act 1,
yes.
Scene 1.
You get that, Brian? The nothing of visual space flips into the electric, vibrant nothing of tactility extended.
Have more than thou showest. Speak less than thou knowest. Lend more than thou owest.
Lend more. See, there's visual space. Usury. What Pound get all upset about? Ezra Pound.
Act 1, Scene 4 of King Lear.
Okay, you can carry on, Brian.
And just trying to get to this AAP thing where McLuhan writes the CNS note beside this idea of the common soul of humanity, the unconscious and the common soul of humanity. McLuhan writes CNS. And then a few pages later where Lewis is talking about Schopenhauer, says, the world for Schopenhauer consists of two things, of will and its objectivation or representation or idea. All object or idea is phenomenal existence, only the will is the thing in itself. And McLuhan has noted beside this CNS above AAP in a way that he seems to be associating CNS with the will, the thing in itself, and then AAP with the object or idea, the phenomenal existence.
Right. It's not acoustic and space. It's not anthropomorphical, unless it is.
Yeah.
It's, you finally found an acronym that I don't know.
My salad days when I was green in judgment. Antony and Cleopatra, Act 1,
wow.
Scene 5.
I think you mentioned Men Without Art earlier, right?
Yeah, 1934 is that book.
Yeah, McLuhan also mentions that in one of his notes, where we're still talking about Schopenhauer, and McLuhan underlines the phrase where Lewis is summarizing Schopenhauer's strategy, that in the face of its eternal mechanical buffooneries, McLuhan underlines eternal mechanical buffooneries, and he also underlines the phrase, strategy of the Hindu sage. So Lewis was basically saying that Schopenhauer's idea was, in the face of the world's eternal mechanical buffooneries, he had a strategy of the Hindu sage. McLuhan underlined strategy of the Hindu sage, and beside it he wrote, SC, Men Without Art Trapped.
So, yes, McLuhan wrote about the Asian horizontal symbolism, the Asian version of Manichaeanism, which was a Gnostic idea that men were puppets of a demiurge. And McLuhan quotes Asian Hinduism or something, has that vision.
These words are razors to my wounded heart. Titus Andronicus, Act 1, Scene 1.
But I don't know what AAP, acoustic, anti-environment, out of the jaws of death?
Do.
Did I hear you say yes when I said anthropomorphic, physical, anthropomorphic?
Yes.
Did you say do?
Do.
So there's something anthropomorphic there in the AAP.
I assume that it's something related to physiology or that it's in the same vein as CNS somehow. So that it might be some sort of a
body system of some kind.
The common curse of mankind, folly and ignorance. Trollius and Quesada, Acts 2, Scene 3.
Maybe I should just play some music so I could catch up here and throw a poem more.
There's a nigger in the woodshed for sure. You pay a great deal too dear for what is given freely. Cressida, Acts 2, Scene 3.
Well, there was one particularly juicy note where McLuhan says the key to Finnegan's Wake, and actually this is right across from, it's interesting, on the left side of the page of what Lewis is writing. On the left side, McLuhan writes, key to Finnegan's Wake, Pierce O'Reilly. And then on the right side of the page, he writes AAP again. So this might give a clue to what sort of physical system we're talking about here. Because Lewis is reacting to some biologist describing insects like a praying mantis when you cut off its head, and it will still go.
Not only will it grow, it'll grow another one. Thus, another gig of time brings its revenges. Taming of the Shrew, Acts 5, Scene 1.
Brian, we are now posting these notes on Ian and Bob.
The problem with the writing is, how do you know the one that wrote the writing wrote the reading right? I am more sinned against than sinning. King Lear, Act 3, Scene 2.
Why are you so focused on these quotes, Bob?
I'm recording what Ian's saying. He's responding to the Wyndham Lewis stuff. He's saying Shakespeare was the first mediaecologist. Lewis was an expert on Shakespeare. So it's appropriate to quote Shakespeare. Lewis wrote about the lion and the fox. He wrote all about Shakespeare.
Nothing in his life became him like the leaving it. He died as one that had been studied in his death to throw away the dearest thing he owned, as to were a careless trifle. Macbeth, Act 1, Scene 4.
Brian, to quote theater is part of what Lewis and Joyce and these guys are dealing with. They're actors in Europe. They're talking about the dramatic effects of electric media. Drama comes back. Visual space subsides. Even though theater is a product of visual space in the alphabet, Greek culture, 500 B.C., especially the tragedy, it's a new dynamic for theater and its relevance in World War One. Like the data is at Cabaret Voltaire. So Ian is quoting from drama to enhance the drama of cognition that Lewis sees extended.
The morning mischief that is past and gone is the next way to draw a new mischief on. Othello, Act 1, Scene 3.
Well, this is pretty... Encyclopedic by Ion. I mean, so...
If you want to quote, Cymbeline is pretty fun. The game is up. Act 3, Scene 3.
That's what that comes from?
I do. Act 3,
what
Scene 3.
What play is that?
Cymbeline count.
The praying cricket, deprived of its head, the organ of generation takes command, and off it, this organ, marches, quite like Gogol's nose, in search of a female. And performs with no problem. An earwig or an ant, similarly cut in half, engages in mortal combat with itself. The proceedings of these insects is a blow to the human personality as well as to their own. ... That was the Lewis quote talking about these insects.
Right.
And right where he says cut in half, talking about an earwig or an ant cut in half, on the right side of that, McLuhan writes AAP, and on the left side, he writes, key to Finnegan's Wake, Pierce O'Reilly.
Now, you know what Pierce...
I think that has to do with it being an earwig.
Yeah, we already heard Pierce O'Reilly in AAP earlier, 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, just not the quote that it was a note to.
First of all, is those insect quotes from Henry Fabre or somebody? There was a famous books on insects that they all were using in the teens. Henry somebody, I think that's a quote from.
That could be. I didn't get the name of the guy.
here's the important point. Pere Sarai is the character that the song on page 44 of Finnings Wake is about. Pere Sarai is the ear guy. And remember, Wyndham Lewis's middle name is Percy. So is teasing Lewis's eye bias, anti-ear. The earwig is the thing that goes into the ear, goes into a man's, a human's brain, and causes a problem in the brain. That's a metaphor for the electric nervous system or the retrieval of acoustic space going around visual space and upsetting Wyndham Lewis. That's very key, the ear dynamic there, symbolized by Pierce O'Reilly. I think he's the guy they sing about. He's the guy who composes a song on page 44. Or maybe it's a guy named Hosty. Forgetting what Paris is particularly, but he's a key character or theme in Finnegan's Wake. And McLuhan's quoting that and then relating it to the
AAP. The devil can cite scripture for his purpose. The Merchant of Venice, Act 1, Scene 3.
Shakespeare, anti-Semitic in that play?
Pretty much. This is the short and long of it. The Merry Wives of Windsor, Act 2, Scene 2.
Guy wrote a lot of play, didn't he? That nobody talks about.
He has eaten me out of house and home. King Henry the Fourth, Part 2, Act 2, Scene 1.
Queen Elizabeth II's family, they weren't called Windsor back then, were they?
No, they were not. That's not what the play was about.
Okay.
I can't tell what the dickens his name is. That was Act 3, Scene 2 of The Merry Wives of Windsor.
Did you get that, Carol?
You made the babies cry. Stop it.
Right.
Stop it.
Who was that? I'm going to get distracted. Is that Act 3, Scene 2?
Not
you
making
said?
Yes, you're facing it distracted. You get that baby happy, and I mean right now, so too done it. Right now.
Yeah.
Just remember, Bob, the miserable have no other medicine but only hope. Measure for Measure, Act 3, Scene 1.
He has AAP as a note 7 or 8 times in this thing.
I'll not budge an inch. Taming of the Shrew, Introduction, Scene 1. I'll not budge an inch.
So remember McLuhan saying objects are unobservable, only relationships among objects are observable?
Yeah.
Well, on page 399, and McLuhan underlines three different key parts of this, Lewis says, objects for us in the course of our daily perceptual abstraction of them are never really looked at all, never directly sensed.
Wow.
Underline objects and never directly sensed. And then a little later on, Lewis says, the sensa world is the world of the unconscious. It is the world of things that, in the usual way, we do not explicitly notice, the world which we repress and push down and away. McLuhan underlines, we repress, and writes, to maintain sense ratio.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's the balancing that automatically goes on. Like Freud's censor was more ethics or something, or sex instinct. But McLuhan goes beyond Freud and talks about the interplay of the sense ratios as the key to censorship in a person's personality.
Absolutely. And to me, that really puts in a new depth on the idea of only relationships among objects are observable, that it's not just a strictly physics quote about you don't see the thing in itself, you just see the light bouncing off of it, that what he's saying, what you see is the relationships of your sense ratio has allowed you to see.
That's a good point.
So, yeah, I like that one a lot.
You got a quote for that, Ion?
Yet do I fear thy nature, it is too full of the milk of human kindness. Macbeth, Act 1, Scene 5.
Yeah, have some more quotes, Brian?
Yeah, I got this really nice, long-ish Lewis quote that's just really funny. It didn't have a McLuhan note beside it, but I got to share this one. It says, first, if you wish to reduce two large objects to one triturated mass, what you begin by doing, probably, is to break up each object into a heap of smaller particulars. You may remark as you are doing this to the little particulars as they appear, you will be very much more important now as individuals than as part of that big lump. I am giving you your liberty. I am restoring to you an identity that was lost in your adherence to that large unit. If they are wise little particulars, they will distrust your disinterested activities and say to themselves,
once become small imitations of the big object, we shall probably be still further disintegrated. Beyond the flux and tripsis, new distinct objects will emerge. But then, on the other hand, what is that distant future to us? Why must we live only for some problematic grandchildren? Transition and change spell nothing but misery for the mass of small particulars, and the new grouping, for all its advertisement of newness, is much the same for us as the old. We always lose, whoever wins. That is how the really astute mass midget would soliloquize.
Did you say mass midget?
Yep.
Wow.
We always lose, whoever wins. That is how the really astute mass midget would soliloquize.
That's amazing. What page is that?
350.
350 of Time and Western Man.
Yeah.
I am. How did Shakespeare one up that?
Love's Labor's Lost.
And that's the name of the play, too, Love's Labor's Lost, right?
Yes.
And that's a phrase. You're using that phrase, the title.
Do.
So I'd like to move on to something else here, Brian. Can you bring up this article?
Gentlemen of Verona.
What about it? You haven't given the quote yet.
That is a quote.
It's just entire plays now. Just the whole play is the
mm-hmm.
quote.
Mm-hmm.
It is referring to me and
we're
Brian
to go,
as two men.
We're
two
trying
men
to go.
Verona.
We're trying to go to the Duke of Milan.
What was that called?
Julian Valentine's Hand.
No, just a minute.
Two Gentlemen of Verona.
Can we hold off on that for a second, Ian?
Till forever, if you want.
What?
We can hold off till forever.
Are you saying two Gentlemen of Verona in response to me and Brian going to another article? Or what are you referring
yes.
to? Okay.
Yes.
So, Brian, can you bring up Squatting the Chapel Perilous, or you can't do that?
I can, actually. I have it already open on a window here.
So this long article by someone named Znor.
Or Suffering Cat.
Wait. Znor, Znore, or Znore, writes this pretty interesting interplay of the themes we're talking about. And he opens with a Wyndham Lewis quote from the novel Tar, the 1928 version of Tar, which was done originally in 1918. Here's the quote. The character Tar, who's sort of modeled on Wyndham Lewis, supposedly.
We know Tar, but that's another conversation.
Yeah, that's Carolyn. Here's to waste, Tar announced loudly to the two waiters in front of the table. Quote, waste, waste, fling out into the streets. Accept fools. Compromise yourselves with the poor in spirit. It will all come in handy. Live like the lions in the forest with fleas on your back. Above all, down with the efficient chimpanzee. The capitalized E, efficient, and capital C. So Snorre begins his article with that quote. Then he says, 1922, year one of the pound era. That would be quoting Hugh Kenner's dedication.
Ezra Pound.
He's got pound era. And then that is
Ezra Pound.
Ezra Pound, you're right. But we go with Don Thiel, who calls it, renames it the Joyce era. But Hugh Kenner.
Oh, Lord. Don Thiel, Lord something. Yeah. Might as well quote William Shakespeare or your. No. I know. Walter Winchell. That'd be. Yeah, go to the source, Bob. Go to Walter Winchell. No,
which was the same
thing. I'll have it in a William Irwin Thompson be quoting stuff and be like Jesus talking himself on something. A bunch of bullshit. Oh, we've declined the steady slopes of our days to a time like this.
Well, who are you quoting? That last quote?
The thicket is beset. He cannot scrape. Two Gentlemen of Verona, Acts 5, Scene 3. Come on, Bob.
Okay, two men. Just a minute, Ian.
Two Men of Verona.
I wish we could hold off of the quoting for a second so that.
Well, you keep on that path you're going down. You're going to speed it up for sure.
Yeah, what was it? Act what, Carol?
Bob is so funny. He acts like this isn't in the recording that's going to last till Jesus. and it's not part of that. He doesn't know anything about that. He can't ever hear it again. So now he has to write it down. So when he listens it again, he'll see if he heard what he wrote down that he heard that he wrote down that he heard that he wrote down. And then he'll use this very same recording to perfect the notes that he's not able to get right now, that he's going to judge the recording by what he wrote down right now. Wait, no. That he's going to write down if he did write down that was written down from then, now. No.
Yeah, I'm not going to write. I'm not re-listening to this. That's why I got to get it right now.
Yeah. There's a zeitgeist in there somewhere, isn't there?
Okay. 1922, year one of the Pound era, referring to Ezra Pound, was also the year that James Joyce, with the immense aid of his editor Ezra Pound, published Ulysses. The themes and literary historical allusions of Ulysses and the Wasteland are so interwoven, so mutually reflecting, that many commentators accuse Eliot of outright plagiarism. Joyce himself, in a letter, wrote a short parody of Eliot's poem. And the parody goes, "But we shall have great times when we return to Clinic, that wasteland of Aesculapius. Shan't we? Shan't we? Shan't we?" And while Joyce played with this, Eliot is one facet of the compound character of Sean the Forger in Finnegan's Wake. While Joyce played with this, he never made any formal accusations against the poet. A more interesting thesis is that Joyce, Pound, Eliot, and likely Yeats, and others, were in full cahoots, all consciously involved in advancing a certain agenda. In Jesse Weston's terms, they were forces and agents of evolution. I call them the vortices. So this guy is pointing out the vortices were had an agenda. Would you agree with that, Ion?
We like Robert's quote better.
Robert on the chat line?
"As long as the milk stays sweet, otherwise there will be men's milk dressed as cows, not bulls."
So where's that from?
Your chat line that you're also not going to post or read.
That's Robert of Tottenham, I think. I don't think he's ever quoted you before. I don't know if you've ever deserved that.
Yeah.
We're going to try to get to the themes here as soon as possible that I identify with Brian. Dublin.
Oh, Robert, I ain't quoted you on the call. Go, Robert. Oh, sorry. Catching up for the note. For putting your notes of the record in the record, so the record will be of the notes. It'll be noted. The record will be noted, right? Right.
Yes.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Dublin on June 16th, 1904.
PJ Mickey O'Rourke.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Mickey O'Rourke. Mickey O'Rourke, the actor.
Yeah. Opinski or PJ Mickey Hooker O'Rourke.
That was odd.
Odder than
Jesus.
What?
We got to stop, Ian. You got to relax, Ian, for a second. We're trying to build on what you've already said. Dublin on June 16, 1904 is also portrayed in Ulysses as being a wasteland. It's not until the thunder claps halfway through the book that the long, anxious wait for the summer rain is interrupted. The thunder is also heard in part 5 of The Wasteland in the section called What the Thunder Said. A single violent blast is heard 3 times. D-A, da. Ion, in the book of Revelation, you point out that the thunders is not explained. Until you show up and explain the thunders, what they symbolize in the book of Revelation. The gang of 5 here, Joyce, Pound, Eliot, Yeats, and Lewis, are they emphasizing the thunder because they know it's not explained in the book of Revelation?
Yes, and you're welcome, Robert. Nice to be feared.
Let's see what Robert's saying. Yeah, Robert says, "Thanks, Ian. Your talks inspire me." NB, I don't know what NB stands for.
Note well.
Yeah. NB means to note.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's
note
pretty good.
Handy.
Oh, yeah, Robert says Ouspensky or PJ Mickey Hooker O'Rourke. Why Tara Lewis was saying, this can't be Robert of Tottenham. This is another Robert. He's writing. Yeah, it's not. This is not Robert of Tottenham. Robert of Tottenham doesn't get many.
Well, you knew it wasn't quotable, so what you going to do?
From the chat line. I'm working my butt off here. It's no fun.
He worked hard for the money.
Bob didn't get it. He's working too hard, Ion.
Yeah, but he's saying he's not going to hear. He's trying to perfect a record that's going to be lost, destroyed, disposed of, thrown away quickly. He'll write his notes and then throw his notes away. It'd be great. Get them right then if you don't toss them.
Do you know what the menu is for Sunday brunch at the Andaz in Wailea, Ion?
Yes, they do cheeses and a fruit spread, and they have omelets. You choose how you want your eggs. They have an omelet bar, or you can do like the Sweeties, the Bear Claws, croissant, and jams. Not like high tea, that's later, but they do like the egg-based stuff. And sometimes they do French toast or other things, but they do that groovy, groovy honeyberry syrup that you like that they had at the market.
Okay.
It's wonderful.
What was your question?
And they have,
the menu at the Andaz. I'm going for brunch tomorrow. Is there anything different from the Grand Wailea brunch, which I've had?
Oh, it is a little different. They have more specialty danishes and stuff.
How's that, Brian, for obscure encyclopedic knowledge that Ion's giving Carolyn?
We got a good sack of Peters here for you.
Now, Robert, he's been doing a lot of commentary. I wasn't noticing it on what we're saying. All kinds of good quotes. Maybe we'll go over them 6 months from now or something. I don't know when.
when he reruns out of McLuhan.
Yeah, he's saying, thanks, Ion. Your talks inspire me. Oh, you already said that.
Look at Sarah goes, do I file habeas corpus for each infraction? You know, Sarah, that Sheila Kern pointed out that the Earl of Shaftesbury he's the ground of Charlotte, South Carolina. That's the Shaftesbury references last week, all referring to Sheila's area. And if you remember, Sarah, you and Sheila had it out on this show, Payday, you know, 6 months ago, 5 months ago. So the Earl of Shaftesbury may be Sheila's revenge on you, Sarah.
So yeah. It is Memorex then, Bob, not live. Sorry, Doug. Maybe next week.
He's responding to Doug, who just posted. So this is live. Okay, Brian, you want to give one more interesting Lewis quote or McLuhan thing?
What would you ask if you could just ask one question?
You're asking Brian. What would Brian ask if Brian got one question?
Well, I guess I'd ask what question to ask or something. they're more important than answers anyway.
Pickles, is that you? Uh-oh, now you've done it. You got Miss Kern on now, by God. It's on now. So just so you know.
How's this for a charismatic ratio, Brian? We sit around while Bob takes dictation.
Yeah, it's a sack of peanuts for dictation, for sure.
Is that you, Pickles? Was that the question, Carol?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sheila's on the chat line.
You hold her and we'll dick her.
Well, Sheila's not even paying attention. Oh, no, she's cracking it. Charleston, South Carolina. Bob takes dictation. Ian speaks the chat line. Carolyn asks about lunch menu. And Brian quotes McLuhan.
And what thing, which act did that come from?
What? We've named several things. But did what come from?
Bob takes dictation. Ian speaks the chat line. Carolyn asks about the lunch menu. That is in Shakespeare, Phineas Tiddlings, Act 2, Scene 3.
Phineas Tiddlings, we don't know that play.
I've never heard of that.
We're sorry. It's in the record now. This show's not even live, so it's not even.
Yeah, according to Doug, Doug's been asking that for 3 hours.
Is this live? Hey. We never claimed to be that, Doug, ever. But what is it, Phineas
Siblings, S-I-B-L-I-N-G-S.
Ian has given us an exclusive new play.
Well, he's written 37 plays, just like I've written 33 books.
Who has? Shakespeare?
Yeah.
You never hear Phineas Siblings cited.
No.
What is the act?
2-3.
Act 2.
2-3. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Brian, so you've asked your question.
Okay, this is all fine. Now let's move on to Sheila's foundational garments now.
For her wedding or just in general?
Oh, in general.
Yeah, Brian, Sheila's getting married. Sheila's getting married next weekend, Brian. Do you have
Okay, how about, it is our contention here that it is because of the subjective disunity due to the separation of the senses that the external disunity has been achieved. That's page 405. That's another one that McLuhan wrote AAP beside.
Okay,
could it be an autonomic? You know, the whole
autonomic. No.
I wonder. That would be very. That would totally fit with the whole central nervous system and like the themes that he generally puts at the side. Autonomic would make a lot of sense.
It would, but it is not what it stands for. Ion, can you bring McLuhan through so that we can check with McLuhan on this?
We have to get something straightened out for Bart. It's not undergarments. It's foundational garments. It's very different. One is panties and one what you wear under your clothes. So get it right.
Look, Sheila's freaking. Somehow all this attention is bringing out her shyness or something. Like she's going, yikes.
Now we're doing Harold Boone bullshit.
Yeah, Suzanne in New York. Harold Bloom is the resident critic of New York City. The anti-environment, attempted fake anti-environment of McLuhan and Northrop Frye. The anxiety of influence was the Harold Bloom's thing.
Sheila's calling someone Grumio.
That is someone. That is someone on there. Grumio. They're all saying, nice work, Sheila. Nice fake job. Pretending you got married. Great way to get attention.
Sheila can get it. It's all right.
Okay, can you bring McLuhan in to explain AAP, Ion?
I think he messed up Anne Olivia Fleurbell.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It was ALP, Brian, but I don't think he messed it up. Don't give Ion an out there. Okay, bring Marshall in. He's hanging back for me anyways. Why don't we tap into him, Ion?
Because he's done. He said he was done. He said, we're through. We're not going to have any more McLuhan. It's done. I've done it all. I'm not doing any more. And I'm not sitting on this goddamn radio without you anymore.
So McLuhan says he's sick of himself.
Sick of himself.
Yeah, it comes through. It says he's had enough of Bob and McLuhan. It comes through and announces his resignation.
I was carefully laid in the sphincter of the fifth body, the fifth and final body.
The fifth body?
The fifth and the final body.
You see, Brian, Ion will not come through when you're really asking for it. He'll quote McLuhan about 2 hours from now. It'll come through.
Somewhere
okay, Brian,
out there, there's a parlor, and we are not doing tricks in it.
Anti-acoustic pace.
Piers. Anthropomorphic piers.
It might be something physical, like the most basic physical substrate.
Auditory. Auditory person.
Before, you don't understand, Bob, before Bill had a pre-recorded program on, thereby the confusion, he now changed it. Or I'm just catching up right now, Bob, so you need to get it right, okay?
I didn't get that. You get that, Carol? Bill's doing something right now.
Yeah, he used to do something, and now he's not doing something.
No, he's quoting Doug Tidwell. Before, Bill had it as a pre-recorded program, thereby the confusion. Now, Bill mislabeled. Bill's been a little off today, I think. Bart, isn't there a supernal body, or is it supernal living? What about supernal?
Hmm.
Also, RHO, which I think is Toronto.
Life is supernal.
And what's that mean? Supernal? You got one, Carol?
Relating to the sky or the heavens, celestial, of exceptional quality or extent. It's like the rhapsode.
Robert asks, Ion, can you please explain the saints and snakes of St. Patrick?
Well, we did, but it was in a recorded show, so you'll have to go to the archives and find it.
You did do it? It sounds familiar. I think we did ask about that a long time ago.
We did. Last Ides of March or the next. No, it's two Ides from now.
Well, we're doing this in-depth textual exegesis. Deb's screaming for some song. Please, play Be Your Sweet Pack Angel. That is you, Bob. Jesus, people are selfish, aren't they?
I'm looking up St. Patrick in my compiled notes, and all I find is Patrick Swayze.
There you go. He died of cancer, too, Bob. He died of
cancer. Look, Susanna says, AAP, always a pleasure. No, it's nice, but it doesn't work.
We think Animal House is better.
Animal can totally work. Well, here's another one. Here's
Prostesia.
One example that
Prostesia.
I think.
Prostesia. Crostesia.
Oh, yeah.
What's Crostesia?
Crostesia.
Okay, Brian, what's it, what did you find?
One of the times he says AAP, there's a little bit of context provided in the note, to where Wyndham Lewis is talking about the supposed wisdom of this unconscious will of Schopenhauer. Lewis says, this never-erring unconscious, so respectfully treated, whose unerringness and fitness and wisdom we are asked so much to admire, we get tired of before long. For we feel that the flattery is misplaced. Our intelligence rebels against this blind god, and we pit our human wisdom against this unerring mess and determine to have as little to do with it as possible. McLuhan underlines our human wisdom against this unerring mess, referring to the unconscious. He underlines that phrase and beside it writes our SC against AAP.
Our subconscious against
no, it's sensory closure against AAP. Now, Adorno creates the phrase authoritarian personality in the late 40s in their description of pop culture, you know, Adorno and Horkheimer. And then LaRouche is against Adorno, and he's anti-authoritarian personality, or LaRouche plays off that.
So AAP, anti-authoritarian personality.
And it was written by Ion. These are not McLuhan's acronyms, Brian. Ion wrote that in. This
okay.
I am fucking putting that there, Brian.
Wow. Good forger.
Good forgery there. But dropping that idea, if you don't like that one, we got others. So what would it be? AAP.
I think it's anti-authoritarian personality. It's a diagnostic label.
I'm more inclined to think it's like autonomic or something about that.
It's an enigma.
Spelled with an A.
S-I. You know, you see, it's S-C and S-I, Brian. Sensory closure.
Yes. Oh, that's C-S-I. That's C-S-I. That's
yeah, TV show. C-S, no, S-C and S-I, which is sensory impact. AAP can be the sensory, the environment.
C-S didn't like Wyndham Lewis, who didn't like any of the Lewis's, who didn't like Jerry Lewis, who didn't like Sherry Lewis. So that's the one. There you go, all the way around, full circle. The answer from Mordecai.
Okay. I mean, I wonder. I didn't look through the entire book from the beginning.
Thank God. We can't stand much more of this, so it's a great thing.
But could you write Eric and ask him?
I'll try. I really want to figure out what this is.
Oh, Mary, she'll drink to it.
She'll drink to it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll make a quest of trying to figure out what that is. Also, I'll send you a mail with the different examples of it that I found and the quotes there before.
Yeah.
Always annoying people, cute cucumbers, anti-authority.
Yeah, it's like a POV.
Pithorups. Show me your pickles. Meow. Adopt a pet. Sheet of bears. All. Bob's in a time warp again. Cats kill us now.
Is he reading from chat?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that could be a good point, Carolyn. I'll check that.
Susanna says he's always annoying people.
Mm-hmm. Accurate.
Great fill of it all. Ion yells out, pickles! Sheila says Bob's in a time warp again. Grumio, anti-authoritarian, anti-disestablishmentarianism personality. Burned from Toronto, I think is where he is. Cute cucumbers.
Sheila's getting tied up with legend.
Yeah, they're getting tight. One last fling before next week. So, Brian, let's see how long we can get away with this Znor article with Ion.
Oh, right, the other article.
Because you've got the DA is this thunder, which is a theme among the gang, the vortices, the agents of evolution. Was there evolution, Ion, the vortices, that's Eliot, Pound, Joyce, Lewis, Yeats, are they on a Gnostic or Manichaean agenda?
Galilean.
A Galilean agenda, which is, what was he, the Dark Knight?
The resting soul of Galileo, time of night vision, god of
night
insight.
Vision. We were quoting Hinduism, so Snorre writes, in his notes, Ellie explains that this anecdote is taken from part 6 of a blah, blah, blah Upanishad. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. The story goes that... Okay, the story goes that first men, then the gods, and then demons. But the gods are the devas, and the demons are the asuras. Each these three phases, each interpreted the terrible syllable of the primal thunder, the da, as the wisdom they respectively most needed to hear. So that data dayadvam damyada means give, sympathize, control. So if you have men should give more, the gods should sympathize more, and the demons are on a control trip. Then Snorre writes, in Ulysses, the coming of the thunder and rain is followed by an incredible babble of voices, of styles of writing, and then by the complete breakdown of the conventional experience of space and time. Now, Ion goes on about space and time, how they don't exist. When Innes is talking about different societies bound by either clay, which is time-bound, or stone, space-bound, Ion, that would be little men environments where they believe there is time and space. They don't know there is no time and space.
We and Doug Tidwell know the answer to your query.
Now, let's see what Doug wrote.
The Association of American Publishers, AAP.
Yeah, I was going to try Googling it to see, like, well, what the...
You know, when everybody gets complaining about their Googler, then everybody wants to see your big old Googler. Are your Googlers fast? Are your Googler is sleeker? Are your Googlers on a note? Or you have a big Googler? You have to watch some Googlers. They're tragic.
So, Ion, this culminates, as Snorre has written before, in Stephen's shattering of the brothel chandelier with his staff. That's in the later chapter, the brothel scene in Ulysses. And the rupture into eternity, then quotes, ruin of all space, shattered glass, and toppling masonry. Pound describes the incident of rupture in a letter to his father, quote, the magic moment or moment of metamorphosis, bust through from quotidian into divine or permanent world, gods, etc. Then Snorre writes, the voice of the thunder then conjures several things at once. It bestows a new, almost angelic or magical language upon mortals, and simultaneously causes an incredible confusion of tongues, a complete breakdown in existing communication. So I see thunder as a new technology comes in, has all the effects that he just said, that Snorre just wrote, and spelled out as tetradic by McLuhan. What is it about the thunder, Ion, that we're not getting that Pound and Eliot and Joyce are referring to, that neither I or Snorre are coming up with? Can you add a point there? What the meaning of thunder in these guys' written works, without quoting Shakespeare.
Oh, well, then we were going to write to Antony and Cleopatra. There you go.
Yeah, no, don't.
Nothing. Dead, gone. Buried, ever, over, in the earth. Done, gone. Yeah,
that's what thunder is about? It's about over?
Echo, over, done. No. The vibrational expressions repeat itself endemically.
Is that endemically or iendemically?
Oh, no.
So, yes, the echoing, I think Snorre talks about the echoing later. So you get that, Snorre? Ion is on you. He's on you.
So did we. Or you can have assholes of applied probability. That's what they do.
Okay, Brian, to get me out of where I'm going, what do you want to ask about in this essay?
I mean, I'm curious. It's clearly some degree of cahoots involved between those artists, or at least the Joyce, Pound, Eliot, Lewis. I mean, Yeats may have been a bit more off to the side, but certainly there's some form of cahoots. But was it, what I'm interested in is, was it just an artistic cahoots, the deliberate, we have these certain aims and we want to advance a certain type of mythology and formal whatever modernism, or was there any kind of a more formalized, actual kind of like intelligence connection?
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Ninth gate, ninth gate.
So it's the non-physical of themselves that's communicating.
Yeah, and it doesn't take long, Sarah. It's quick.
So, Ayana, are they responding to the emptying of the guff, the thinning of the veil? Is that what the vortices describe?
The horse-swallowing vortices will note that, yes.
Did you say horse, H-O-R-S-E, or W-H-O-R-E?
W-H-O-R-E.
Grumia says, what's the ninth gate, Ayana? That's the famous book, 1660s, by somebody that the Vatican suppressed.
Travarchia.
Very important book about traveling to other worlds that was considered satanic by the Vatican or whoever controlled the propaganda back then in the 17th century.
Well, look, Ma, it's the devil. It's the devil.
Did you say Dick Clark?
Yeah, he's the devil.
And so that's a movie, Grumio, The Ninth Gate. Check that movie out with Johnny Depp.
No, that's The Water Boy. That's The Water Boy with Adam Sandler.
The Water Boy. He's changing it, Grumio. It can get confusing. You have to go back and listen to all the archives to figure out where we went off the tracks here.
Which we're never going to do, so it's okay, because it's not even a live show anyway, so it's okay.
Yeah, you know, people, Brian, are putting in all kinds of acronyms, Annals of Applied something, Angel-Assisted Portaling. But
I
know
like
McLuhan does not mean that. He actually means something within his language.
Angel-assisted portaling makes sense. Not so much for the context, but that's a really good one.
Yeah, American Atheist Press.
Always another person. Always another possibility.
Assholes aren't for pickles.
Okay, carrying on with the essay. It is the combination, the overlay of the day of Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit first descended and granted the apostles the gift of tongues, and the fall of the Tower of Babel, the fourth fall after Lucifer, Adam, and the flood. Babel and Pentecost represent respectively the fall and redemption of language. The voice of the thunder reminds us that both are really simultaneous events, a gate or door that opens both ways. You would agree with that, Ian, if you're going to take the dyadic approach, the two-ness. It's an interplay of the fall and the redemption are the same thing. Would you agree they are simultaneous events?
The indemnification of each, if you do it that way, then okay.
I remember indemnification is a legal term, so we got to look that up. Presumed guilt or presumed in?
Get you a habeas.
You have to provide a compensation for a particular loss suffered by another person, so it's kind of like guilt. So what did Ian just say, Carolyn, about indemnification? Or Brian, did you catch the phrase?
I didn't, actually. I was thinking about another type of simultaneity that it's like simultaneous.
It's a hard time because we're rambling around all the place. You all can't keep on the same topic of what you're talking about. I know, it's right. Occupy the chat room.
The two directions of fall and redemption, are they simultaneous? Like
indemnify to protect someone by promising to pay for the cost of possible future damage, loss, or injury. Thank you, Bart.
Indemnification. Responding to snore.
Stop being so hung up on your notes, Bob. You're worse than me.
For God's sake, this is a recorded radio show already.
Yeah, but
boy,
people don't really.
Boy, this would be a son of a bitch if it was live, wouldn't it?
So, you got a thought? The Znor lives in Japan.
Note to self. Bob takes note on indemnification item. Yeah.
Now, Znor gets close to the electric environment when he says, it is within this electrically charged clap of thunder, in the very thick of both confusion and grace, that we find ourselves. It's just before dawn of the third day, in the infinite space between collapse and renewal, between oblivion and utopia. It is as if we are hearing the command from the sky for the first time. Guy and Batista Vico, a major source for James Joyce, arrives at the same story as the Vaidyanayaka Upanishad.
And a can of poutine.
As though it's written here, in ignorance of the much older Indian scripture.
We read it live when we did it the first time.
Yeah, we're going to ask about the word giants. So in Gambetis is the new signs written in 1725. Guy Bautista de Vico says, thereupon a few giants, who must have been the most robust and who were dispersed through the forest on the mountain heights where the strongest beasts have their dens, these giants were frightened and astonished by the great effect whose cause they did not know and raised their eyes and became aware of the sky. They pictured the sky to themselves as a great animated body, which in that aspect they called Jove, the first god of the so-called greater gents, who meant to tell them something by the hiss of his bolts and the clap of his thunder. And thus they began the natural curiosity, which is the daughter of ignorance and the mother of knowledge, and which, opening the mind of man, gives birth to wonder. So Snorre comments on that by saying, becoming first aware of the sky, and I had mentioned the sky earlier, becoming first aware of the sky in wonder, we learned generosity, compassion, and self-control. These are lessons which we are being compelled to learn again. And should we choose to listen, the voices can be heard from both the overworld and the underworld, from the gods or from the seers. Nayan, you are not asking us to learn generosity, compassion, and self-control again, are you?
Hell no, we could give a happy damn about that bunch of bullshit.
So, Snorre, this is your lesson from Ion, is that you're putting in the pre-Ionic archetypes of wisdom in your projection of what the vortices were up to. Now, Ion, were Joyce, Eliot and Pound, and Lewis urging evolution toward what you just said you're pushing for, if we can be so crude, and they weren't into generosity, compassion, and self-control? Can we say that's what the vortices definitely weren't promoting?
Mostly it's from the disease of Clarendon.
The disease of Clarendon.
Aziz, A-S-S-I-Z-E.
The Siege of Clarendon was an 1166 act of Henry II of England that began the transformation of English law from systems for deciding the prevailing party in a case.
Now, this is really important, Brian. Henry II, that's in the 1100s, I think. And that's the date in Finnegan's Wake, 1132, even though it doesn't refer to anything in particular, maybe.
Right.
It can refer to the big events of Henry II. And that's when Ireland started to get in trouble. Bristol, I don't know, some sale. Ireland got sold to somebody. That's a major betrayal. So this phrase comes from that, eh?
It's an actual name of an act, an A-C-T.
Okay, can you spell exactly? A-S-S-I-Z-E?
Correct, of Clarendon. C-L-A-R-E-N-D-O-N.
And I think that's what Barry Nevington lived on Clarendon Street in Toronto. A-S-S-I-Z-E, right?
Yeah.
And that's Henry II.
Yeah.
Do you have a date?
1166.
That's very Finneganese, that. Ian is on the ball here. That's very important in the history of Ireland. Henry II, 1166. This could get into an Earl of Shaftesbury kind of echoing resonance, where what Ian is saying was achieved here resonates right down the next 1,000 years. And what is it that what happened there, Carol?
That was an act that began the transformation of English law from systems for deciding the prevailing party in a case, especially felonies, as trial by ordeal or trial by battle or trial by compurgation, C-O-M-P-U-R-G-A-T-I-O-N, to an evidentiary model, in which evidence, inspection, and inquiry was made by laymen, knights, or ordinary freemen under oath. So before that, they, you know, in the witch trials, they used to say, well, if she doesn't drown, she's a witch and we'll burn her. But if she does drown, she wasn't a witch, but she's still dead.
This changed that?
Yeah, used to be trial by ordeal or by battle. You know, you'd fight a duel. But now they went on evidence.
So that's the beginning of visual space, early visual space. Seeing is believing. Well, I rest my case. I'm just going to listen. You idiots who are there listening. Remember, the point on this show is not to listen. The point is to speak. We are not impressed with people who sit around for fucking years listening to us. Fuck you. No fucking listening tolerated here.